Hello, I'm Abigail. Welcome to Philosophy Tube. I've got a bit of a special treat for you this month. Athena, the goddess of wisdom, got in touch with me. Turns out she's a huge fan of the show, and she offered to let me use her magical library to research today's episode. This room actually contains all the knowledge in the universe. She's got everything. Secrets of quantum physics, the truth about Atlantis, a list of all of my romantic failures in alphabetical order. There's just one problem. Today's episode isn't about knowledge. It's about ignorance. The study of ignorance is a relatively new and cutting-edge field in philosophy. It actually has its own name, agnotology. It comes from the ancient Greek words agnosis and logos, which translate into English as Martin from Year 9. Oh, sorry, it's romantic failures again. Anyway, ignorance is a pretty broad topic. It touches on all sorts of things, like privacy, deliberately keeping other people ignorant of something. Justice, is justice blind? Politics, how do we deal with things like misinformation and public ignorance? It also comes into play in mathematics when we think about uncertainty and probability, although we won't be talking about those today because I only know three things about mathematics. One, I'm not very good at it, and B, I'm also not very good at it. We'll also be looking at censorship, including a real example that affected my life in a major way, and which raises perhaps the most pressing question of all. They say that people are afraid of what they don't understand. But what if some people don't want to understand? You might be surprised to hear that some philosophers thought a little bit of ignorance can be a good thing. John Rawls was a very well-respected American philosopher of justice, and he thought that society should be a cooperative system based on rules. But that prompts the question, how do we decide on the rules? Left to their own devices, people will come up with rules that benefit them but screw over everybody else. So how do we make sure they decide on good ones? The solution, he said, was a veil of ignorance. A just society could be designed by a committee of people who do not know what position they will occupy in that society. So we take a bunch of people and we erase their memories so they don't know anything about the world or themselves. They're allowed to know what kind of human beings there are and what sorts of things we need and enjoy, but other than that, nothing. And this group of people, behind the veil of ignorance, they will choose the rules. They're allowed to know everything they need to do their jobs, but absolutely nothing else about the world or humanity. So it's kind of like going to Cambridge. The idea is that if you don't know whether you're going to be the president or an unemployed single mum, you'll design a society where unemployed single mums can do okay, because once you come out from behind the veil of ignorance, that might be you. Of course, in real life, it's not possible to do this. Rawls' thought experiment belongs to the kind of philosophy we call ideal theory. That's where we think about what might happen under ideal circumstances and see if it tells us anything interesting about the actual circumstances. Rawls' thought experiment is an example of how ignorance marks out the boundaries of a discussion. We ignore, that is, we remain ignorant of, everything that is deemed not relevant. So knowledge and ignorance are two sides of the same coin. In Rawls's case, the committee's ignorance of their self-interest structures their knowledge of justice. And there are real-life justice systems that work a little bit like this. Juries might be told to ignore certain evidence in a trial, for instance. You might have racked up thousands of pounds in library fines by checking out weird catgirl mangas and not returning them, but you're on trial for the much lesser crime of murder, so the jury will remain blessedly ignorant of that. This is a key point in agnotology, so it's worth making sure that you understand. Ignorance isn't just the blank waiting to be filled in. Ignorance gives knowledge its structure. If you're very clever and you've watched my last episode on ideology, you might remember the idea that political ideologies are defined just as much by what they don't say as what they do say, the notes that aren't being played. It's the same kind of thing.
Ignorance is not a motionless state. It is an active accomplishment requiring ever-vigilant understanding of what not to know.
So here's something cool. What if we take this idea that ignorance gives knowledge its structure and we turn it back on John Rawls himself? He's deliberately remaining ignorant of the actual state of justice in the world to think about what things would be like in ideal circumstances, because that's what ideal theory does. But what if ideal theory isn't the right way to do it? The philosopher Charles Mills criticized this move, saying that remaining ignorant of society's problems is hardly likely to generate good solutions, and may in fact be why those problems continue. If you put ignorance in, you'll surely get ignorance out. In particular, Mills highlights that Rawls doesn't really mention racial injustice all that much, which is a pretty big oversight for a philosopher of justice to make.
A political philosophy thriving for 30 years that makes next to no mention of the centrality of racial injustice to the basic structure of the United States, and assumes instead that it will be more theoretically appropriate to start from the ideal theory assumption that society is the product of a mutually agreed on non-exploitative enterprise to divide benefits and burdens in an equitable way. This is somehow going to illuminate the distinctive moral problems of a society based on exploitative white settlement. One does not confront a history of racial domination by ignoring it, since to ignore it is just to incorporate it through silence into the conceptual apparatus, whose genealogy would typically ensure that it is structured so as to take the white experience as normative.
Normative there means giving values. It comes from the ancient Greek word nomos, which translates into English as Jennifer from second year of university. Sorry, this keeps happening. When Mills and other philosophers talk about taking the white experience as normative, they mean that there are certain things that white people remain ignorant of. Mills talks about white ignorance, capital W, capital I. And I bet that some people will hear that term and they'll go, because we're used to thinking of ignorance as a bad thing. Ignorant is an insult, right? Well, that's not necessarily how philosophers use it. An example of white ignorance might be, I don't know what it's like to be racially profiled by the police, for instance. That's not something I can know. When we, white people, try to design neutral, ideal systems that use ignorance to set the boundary of what's relevant, we, of course, use our own ignorance to set that boundary. So the neutral ideal system ends up reflecting the viewpoints of the white designers. Ignorance in, ignorance out. This is another key point in agnotology. Ignorance isn't just a natural thing that happens. It's created and reinforced by society. So what if, instead of pretending that it's not there, we tried to figure out why people become ignorant in the first place? Philosophers sometimes distinguish between passive ignorance and active ignorance. Passive ignorance is when you just don't know something, like, I don't really know all that much about owls. No offense. There's just some things that I don't need to know. Active ignorance is when you go out of your way to make sure that you don't know something, to ignore it, because you need to not know. And that's where things get interesting. For instance, I am not, at time of recording, a vegetarian. Maybe I will be someday. I have tried a few times, and if I'm honest, it made me pretty miserable. But I am aware, because I have vegetarian and vegan friends, that if I were to really look into what factory farming is like, it's possible that would make me even more miserable than not eating meat would. And so, I don't look into it. In order to avoid being miserable, I deliberately remain ignorant. And most of the time, I don't even think about that ignorance. I'm deliberately ignorant of my deliberate ignorance. This is an example of what philosopher Jennifer Foster calls doxastic anxiety. That's anxiety about forming beliefs. I don't want to believe that eating meat is wrong, so I remain deliberately ignorant of anything that might change my mind. It comes from the ancient Greek word doxa, which translates into English as Rebecca from that one nightclub in Essex. there's a subtle point here, which you might disagree with, which is that believing or not believing something can be a moral matter. In other words, morality isn't just about your actions, eating meat or not. There are moral ways to think as well. You can be doxastically cowardly or doxastically brave. And you might be like, whoa, that sounds like some thought crime 1984 shit. Surely I can believe whatever I like. Surely it's my actions that count. And it is certainly a step away from John Rawls, who thought that justice was basically about the distribution of stuff and opportunities. But that depends on your view of morality. If you think that morality is just about the consequences of your actions, then yeah, okay. But in recent years, philosophers have started talking about having the right intellectual virtues. If I get to heaven someday, and my old philosophy teacher's there, and he says, so, how do you think that went? I'll have to say, well, Mr. Baker, I don't think I tried my best. When it came to the question of whether or not it's right to eat meat, I dodged the question. Is that on its own grounds for not getting into heaven? Is there a certain point at which denial itself becomes morally wrong? Well, maybe to answer that one, we could look at a real-life example. Riddle me that, and riddle me this. What kind of death is born in bliss? Riddle me further, if you're such a bright spark, what kind of light keeps you in the dark? Tobacco companies in the early 20th century were living large. But by the 1950s, the evidence was trickling in that smoking is incredibly bad for you, and big tobacco had a big problem. How do we keep people ignorant? Or at least ignorant enough that they'll keep smoking. By the way, occasionally on this show, I use smoking and fire as metaphors for fascism, but in this episode, I am talking about literal tobacco companies. And they came up with a very villainous solution. You start off by saying, this evidence looks pretty serious. So we are going to fund a whole bunch of medical research to figure out whether our product really does cause lung cancer. We are going to pay for it out of our own pockets, because that's how much we care. And then you set up a study looking into whether anything other than smoking causes cancer, like air pollution or dust mites or fatty foods, it doesn't matter. Does jazz cause cancer? I don't know. Here's $1 million to find out. Your study obviously comes to the conclusion we can't know for sure, because cancer does have complex causes, and one scientific study is never going to be 100%. You don't actually have to come down either way. So long as you conclude by saying, these results demonstrate the need for further research. And that is now your headline. More research needed into cigarettes cancer link, say scientists. Everybody who smokes will read that and go, ah, a perfect excuse to not think about whether or not this is killing me. I will indulge my doxastic anxiety and remain in the dark. Pass me a light. This is fully evil genius level shit. Evil because, let's not forget, cigarettes are addictive and they kill millions of people every year. And genius because you don't have to be evil to go along with it. You can hire honest scientists to investigate the legit question of whether air pollution causes lung cancer. You can hire honest editors and graphic designers to print your findings in a nice glossy magazine and distribute it. You can rely on honest journalists to report both sides. If you just paid people to lie, then they'd have to be as villainous as you. But you don't even have to do that. You just have to ask the right questions. And you can use this playbook for anything. Why stop at cigarettes? Do it for opioid painkillers as well. Do it for lead paint, asbestos, CFCs, beryllium. Do it for political stuff. Do it for gun crime. Do it for debt buildup in the financial system. Do it for police racism. Do it for terrorism studies. Do it for trans healthcare. Just so long as the debate never stops and the matter is never settled. As one cigarette company executive put it, doubt is our product. And if the balance of the evidence does start to tip against you, you've got one more trick up your sleeve. Pretend like it's old news. Like, yeah, everybody knows that cigarettes cause lung cancer. We certainly never denied that. Our product is about rebellion and choice and freedom. Everybody knows that it's addictive and that it kills you. And if everybody knows it, well, there's no need to keep bringing it up. Did the owners of cigarette companies really believe that their product was safe? Do they still? Maybe some people are genuinely cynical and don't care what happens to the rest of the world, but I think that for a lot of us, for certain topics, the doxastic anxiety is just too great. We'll take any excuse to not think about it, even if it means death. Ignorance is bliss. Riddle me square or riddle me round. What kind of explosion makes no sound? In 1942, the United States had a problem. They were working on a project, a very special kind of project, coordinated from Manhattan, trying to build a very special kind of bomb. But they weren't the only ones. Across the Atlantic in Nazi Germany, Hitler's scientists were racing to do the exact same thing. So the American plans had to be kept secret. As a matter of global security, people needed to be ignorant. When it comes to classified secrets, there's two kinds. The first is stuff like, the troops will land at dawn. It's very simple, so it's easy to leak, but it's got a limited shelf life. After dawn tomorrow, it's not really going to matter if everyone knows. And it's also not really something that you could figure out unless somebody tells you. Compare that to the second type of secret. Something like how to build a nuclear bomb. Now that is very complicated, so it's harder to leak, but it doesn't have a shelf life. You've got to keep it secret forever. And this is the really dangerous part. It's something that your enemies could, in theory, figure out on their own. If they've got the resources and the scientists and the labs and the time, they could learn your secrets by going the long way round. And that means that if you're trying to keep the secret, you also have to keep all the research you did to get there secret as well. The Americans didn't just classify the final design, they had to classify all the little steps they did to get to it, like how to enrich uranium and even basic principles of atomic physics that they discovered, because if you know that, then you can start to join the dots. The Nazis spent ages fiddling on with heavy water, trying to use it as a neutron moderator. Meanwhile, the Americans were like, actually, graphite works much better, but shh, the truth can be explosive, so keep it silent. Keeping a lot of information secret like that is very difficult, it's very expensive, it's very inefficient, and the more secrets the government keeps, the more heavy-handed they have to be about protecting them. And this is not a problem that has gone away. Certain parts of the US and UK governments are, right now, toying with the idea of removing public funding from schools and universities that teach divisive woke concepts. The plan is that legislators want to keep people ignorant of ideas that they believe are harmful or extreme, that there are some ideas that must just be ruled out as illegitimate, not even worth hearing, because hearing them might threaten the existence of a system in which any ideas are expressible. Now, that on its own isn't a particularly new concern, though, of course, the devil is in who chooses the ideas that are too dangerous to hear, and which ideas will they choose? For our philosophical purposes today, though, there's two things we could note. Firstly, divisive woke concepts are much more like that second kind of secret, because people could figure them out on their own. Let's take communism, for example, since I assume that's going to be on the list. You could ban every copy of the Communist Manifesto. You could ban everyone from reading Karl Marx. But if you just, like, work in a pub and have your eyes open, you can see that society is divided into different classes of people based on their relationship to owning stuff. And society is generally structured around satisfying the desires of the owner class rather than the working class. Even if you wouldn't use that language, the Marxism is already inside of you. And you can't stop that. Even if your grandkids are working on Mars in the Elon Musk salt mines in 100 years with no Karl Marx anywhere on the planet, there'll still be nothing stopping them going, hang on a minute. Well, this is shit. And because they are like that second kind of secret, if you want to keep people ignorant, you can't just ban a few books. You're going to have to get seriously repressive. Secondly, it's interesting that these legislators claim the concepts themselves are divisive. The civil rights organizer Kwame Ture was often accused of being divisive, and he said, well, no, I'm not. I'm just drawing people's attention to divisions that already exist. Inequality and injustice are real. What you're doing is just ordering us all to ignore them. If you think back to what we learned earlier on about ignorance marking out the boundaries of a discussion, we can see how a philosopher like Charles Mills might interpret this not just as an attempt to keep the public ignorant, but an attempt to build white ignorance specifically into the structure of society. And if you want a real-life example of something like that happening with very serious consequences, then I've got one for you. Riddle me shameful, or riddle me proud. What is the number of silence out loud? Riddle me mad, or riddle me sane. What kind of love dares not speak its name? This is a real newspaper article. It's from The Telegraph from a couple of weeks ago. And as soon as I saw it, I knew that I had to talk about it on the show, because it's a perfect case study of everything we've learned today. It's by a British journalist called Victoria Lambert, and it's titled We Need to Talk About Sex Education. And it's pretty standard hashtag content, you know. She's saying that the sex ed she got in school wasn't very good, it didn't teach her about consent, and parents should tell their kids about that. Pretty standard mainstream feminist stuff. And it's got some interviews with other white cisgender journalists who all agree. What caught my eye was two of those other interviews. One with a guy called Alex Denny, who said LGBT sex ed was completely absent from my all-boys school. And another with a guy called Jack Rear, who is himself a gay man, who also said he wasn't given any gay sex ed. And what nobody mentions is that until relatively recently, LGBT sex ed in Britain was illegal. In the UK, we used to have this thing called Section 28. It was a law that was passed by the Thatcher government in 1988, which made it illegal for any local authority to A, intentionally promote homosexuality or publish material with the intention of promoting homosexuality, and B, promote the teaching in any maintained school of the acceptability of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. So, first things first, the text of the law is obviously explicitly homophobic. It contains the central claim of homophobia, which is that gay relationships are not as good as straight ones. Earlier on, we learned the concept of white ignorance, capital W, capital I. Similarly, we might talk about straight ignorance or cisgender ignorance, and those too can be built into the law. There were huge protests. A group called the Lesbian Avengers abseiled into the House of Lords to disrupt the session, and they invaded the BBC news studio during the live broadcast of the 6 o'clock news. But the bill passed, and this was the law until 2003. When David Cameron became Prime Minister, he apologised for Section 28, despite having been a big supporter of it. And to be fair, even if you like David Cameron, you've got to admit it's a bit rich to be taking lessons on sexual ethics from a man who f***ed a pig. The law itself was, in parliamentary language, f***ing dog s***. It was really vague and unclear, but it had strong effects because it made people scared. Or it gave them an excuse to do what they wanted to do anyway. The idea was that you couldn't promote homosexuality to children, but in practice that meant that we weren't allowed to know about it at all. so LGBT books were taken off the shelves of local libraries, some theatre companies were denied Arts Council funding if they were too gay, some films weren't allowed to be shown in schools or in council venues. It had a big silencing effect that went way beyond what the actual text of the law required, even in private schools, and even after it was repealed. I remember when I was a kid, and my school taught us about sex. They said, "Now then, boys, when you go to bed with a woman, or a man, the penis is inserted into the vagina thusly. Now, go get 'em." And that was it. That was what we were taught. And then 20 school kids were like, "Hawthorne, she's talking about you, is your f***ing gear?" Like, that was it. Section 28 was supported by a lot of British newspapers, including The Telegraph. Section 28 is an example of what philosopher Miranda Fricker calls hermeneutical injustice. Hermeneutical means to do with interpreting. It comes from the ancient Greek word hermeneutikos, which translates into English as, "Three of my previous girlfriends turned out to be lesbians and I still didn't realize I was trans." A hermeneutical injustice is when someone gets denied the knowledge they need to understand and take control of their life. And they are denied it because they are a member of a certain group. An example that Fricker gives is a conservative lady who experienced postnatal depression, but who'd never been told that that was a thing. That term wasn't always around. If you experienced anxiety or depression after having a child, people used to just say that you're a bad mother. And this lady describes the first time she heard that term used at a feminist workshop.
"In that one 45-minute period, I realised that what I'd been blaming myself for, and what my husband had blamed me for, wasn't my personal deficiency. It was a combination of physiological things and a real societal thing. Isolation. That realisation was one of those moments that makes you a feminist forever."
Something that might be worth noting is this woman describes that moment not as being taught that she's a victim or divisive woke grievance studies or anything like that. She describes it as liberating. Not divisive, but uniting. Section 28 didn't mention transgender people at all, but this was a time in which a lot of straight cis people were ignorant of the fact that being gay and being trans are two totally different things. So it put the kibosh on us as well. My school just did not tell me that being trans was a thing. I did not knowingly meet another trans person until I was already an adult. I remember the first time I did. I met this girl at my uni and I said, "Hey, dude." And she said, "I'm actually a woman. I'm a trans woman." And I said, "What's that?" And she told me and I was like, "How, that's fucking gay." How might my life have been different if somebody had just told me when I was a kid? That's years of my life I've wasted in ignorance that I can never get back. And you know, you can go mad thinking about that sort of thing. I made it in the end. You got to play the hand you're dealt. But I didn't know, and I didn't know that I needed to know. I was ignorant. Firstly, because that ignorance was deliberately built into the structure of the society I was born in. And secondly, for a while, I was too doxastically anxious to really sit down and think about it. And that is agnotology. And maybe that's why Socrates was the wisest man in Athens. Because he said, "I know that I know nothing."
That's why we sitting on the wrong track, back to the long track. And it's okay to be rich. My mama always told me I was destined for greatness. But my mama also, she told me take care of the kids and everybody around the world that can fight for it. So it's Hakuna Matata, beast on the water, pray to provider, please don't divide us. Keep that and try to face your intruder to be someone brighter. Yeah, I don't mind if you don't listen that much. Some of y'all don't.